Hi, everybody. Welcome to tonight's episode of Talk Openly. My name is Daniel, and our friend Jack, my usual co-host, is on vacation right now and taking a little break from the show. And so we are joined by the ever wonderful Mr. Matthew Cruz. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Daniel. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm stoked. I'm so happy to have you here with us. You've been on the show before as a guest, and we both, Jack and I, thoroughly enjoyed it. And I'm like, absolutely, even though I love doing the show with Jack, I'm enthusiastic about some variety and having you on here. Matthew is my good friend, and he is a Sangha member at Lion's Roar Dharma Center, and he leads meditation classes there, usually Wednesday nights, the beginning meditation class. I'm a big fan. What's that, Matthew?
With Sue Forrester, she's a nice friend. And
that's right. Later. We're never alone here. And Matthew's definitely not doing the beginning meditation alone. He has Sue Forrester, who is also our good friend with him at doing that. So thanks so much for joining us, Matthew. I'm stoked, like I said. And, you know, so normally the format of the show, we could just stick to it. Normally, Jack and I talk a little bit about how our meditation practice is going, our training is going, and if anything's sort of noteworthy going on in our lives within the last week or so. And then we'll do a little bit of Lojong slogan training and move on to the topic for tonight, which is talking about bringing mindfulness and using meditation practices to address trauma in our lives. And so we'll definitely get to that topic, but maybe we can start just a little bit by, you know, how is your week, Matthew? How's your training going?
It's funny because I sometimes have the to say something to the effect of my training is very consistent. And when I say that, what I mean is that every day around the same time, I do some specific trainings. The base is always some prayers and 24 minutes of shamatha as Lama requests of his students. And then I also will do some other training depending on my time and day and what my personal needs are in that moment. But really, even though there's like that similarity in time and that I do that before I conduct other activities in my life, it doesn't actually feel consistent. And that's been a very interesting point for me lately, in that the experience can never actually be recreated. And how the training and sessions go is very fresh and different each time.
Yeah, I like that you, I like the way that you describe that. So there's that, the consistency of like the routine, right? In the sense that you're, like you said, you're doing it sort of on this, you know, at this around the same time every day, and the practices are similar, probably, right? In terms of like the structure, but what your actual meditation experience is like, and what's happening in those sessions is incredibly unique, right? It's never you're never going to experience that exact same thing again.
I don't know if it's incredibly unique. I mean, there is a lot of standardization to the training, and I think that's one of the benefits of it. But I think in a in like kind of a very simple a simple way, there's difference.
It's sort of like that. You remember there's that old Greek philosopher Heraclitus, and there was a saying by him that was like something to the effect of the same man doesn't step into the same river twice, right? But if you step into the river again, you're going to have an experience of getting wet, right? Like that's going to happen. And maybe at sometimes the water will be rushing, and sometimes it's a little bit, a little bit slower. Sometimes it's muddy, sometimes it's clear. Is that what you're talking about?
Am.
Nice. I like the consistency aspect of it. I myself struggle with that. I have an incredibly crazy schedule. It's not even a schedule, right? It's just lots of busyness, rushing, right? All kinds of things happening every day. And I really enjoy when my life settles down enough that I can have that like same time every day, same place, everything like that. But lately it's been anything but consistent. What I do like, what I am happy to say though, is that I'm regular. Right? So it's not the same time every day. It's certainly not exactly the same kind of format every day, but I am regularly doing the practices and find them incredibly beneficial. I had a cool thing happen today, Matthew. I like to mix it up a little bit. I think that you hinted at it as well, right? Depending on, whatever's going on in your lived experience. But I had this interesting experience today in meditation where I was trying to do, not trying, I was doing a little bit of Tonglen practice before my shamatha, right? I'd heard somewhere a little bit of instruction to the effect of trying to do or try to start the shamatha practice with a little bit of Tonglen. So I was doing that, and I start with myself, and then I don't usually pick ahead of time like who or what's going to be the next entity, right, that I do Tonglen with. But usually it's a person, right? And it just sort of shows up. It's just somebody, maybe a friend, a loved one, someone I'm having difficulties with, whatever. Today I was like inspired. I was inspired to do Tonglen for these three dogs that I live with, right? So it's a Chihuahua and a medium-sized dog and a big-sized dog, right? And I love these guys, but I don't think I've ever done Tonglen for an animal before. And so I was sort of surprised when I was inspired to do that. And it was incredible, right? It was neat to experience that sort of connection with, the fact that it's all beings, right? All of these beings are similar to me in the sense of them wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. And it was so beautiful to offer them up this sort of light, positive, this feeling of wanting to be beneficial towards them, right? And so the practice was, it blew me away. I was like, oh man, I've never done that with animals before, but I found that it was quite different than working with humans.
What did you find that was the source, the primary source of their suffering?
That's a good question. I tend not to, I noticed in the beginning that I was identifying with their ignorance, and not identifying with it, but recognize, like I was like, man, they're really kind of limited, right? In terms, they can't branch out too much beyond their doghood. But I try when I'm doing Tonglen, I don't get overly involved with either, the source of their happiness or their suffering, nor what it is that they need from me, right? Like I generally, it's just more sort of this, it's more general, right? But I noticed in the beginning that it was primarily associated with this sort of being stuck as in their sort of very limited framework.
And so when you breathe in, do you feel their suffering?
Yeah, I do. I do. In fact, so I do. So when I do Tonglin, I'll switch back and forth between these two different styles. One of them is a soft style where it's this, the visualization is like dark cloud, heavy, you know, this sort of dark energy, if you will. And then it's going out is like light and colorful, very light feeling. This other one is a harder method that I was told came from Lama, and that is one where you visualize this it's the suffering of the other coming and pen it's like an arrow, like a dark, heavy arrow that penetrates into your heart, into this little coal of your own suffering, right? And then it explodes into like little diamonds. It's very energetic. And I was doing that with the animals. And I definitely felt I felt that suffering. But you know what was, I'll tell you what was transformative about it for me was I came into the whole thing with this, I was feeling super anxious and kind of bound up, kind of tight, which of course the animals, they feel that as well at times. But I was, it was pretty pronounced. And not necessarily like condition. It was not based upon any, there wasn't something happening, causing any, like a thought pattern or anything. It was just sort of free floating anxiety, if you will, breathing sort of up in my chest and that kind of thing. And it was such that process, that energetic process of being struck by these arrows from the dogs, right? And having it explode like that, it really kind of blew that away, right? It was a really beautiful experience.
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
It's amazing, and trying to heal others, we're healed.
Indeed, indeed. You know, when I first started doing Tonglin, I always thought it was, I was like, man, this stuff is, it's pure magic. And I still believe it's magic, but in a different sort of way, right? I was like, this in the beginning, I was like, no, really, this is real magic. I'm affecting those other beings through some kind of energetic exchange or whatever. But now I notice actually more of the personal transformational quality, right? Where there's a softness. What I recognize is that like with the dogs, for example, I love those guys, right? I take them out for walks every day, multiple times, clean up all their poop, feed them, make food for them. All, you know, I really care for them. But there are these times like, you know, where they're obnoxious, right? And I get like super irritated and maybe like angry with them or whatever. And I noticed how, like, when I was offering, you know, to them this sort of the, you know, what they needed in order to be happy and free, you know, I was that there was this feeling of like, yeah, I actually need to chill out a bit, you know, in some of that. Like, if I'm out walking and they, you know, if I'm walking for their benefit, right? I'm not, I'm, it's primarily for them that I'm out walking. And so if they need to stop and smell a good pee spot, right? Like I just chill. Like that's what I'm there for, is for their happiness, right? I'm not, I don't need to keep moving. I can just like hang out and let them do their thing, right? And so there was a that it was really kind of a fascinating thing, like noticing how, you know, yeah, they're suffering partially is due to me, you know, their condition of being bound up with me on a leash, right? When we're out walking. And what they really want is to stop and smell the roses, so to speak. And sometimes I won't allow that because of my own needs. Anyway, that's probably enough of that.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure I was reading about Lojong, and I think Mipham's meditation instructions, and he was very clear, which I found fascinating, because this is a very traditional lineage teacher that in the practice he was like, yeah, like no, nothing's happening for anybody else. Like,
Right.
but you should still do it, you know? And the reason being is we're training ourselves to have that experience that you just described, where like anytime we're pulling back into a self-centered place, like we're trained mentally to be like, well, no, I'm gonna take in their suffering, I'm gonna give them goodness. You know, like the basis of bodhicitta.
Yeah, you know, and what's great about that is that indeed, by reducing our own self-centeredness, it does benefit them. It's just not in some woo-woo way, right? It's not there. It is magical, right? It does actually benefit the other beings to the degree that we have some influence over their lives, right? And I find that to be it's like practical magic.
It's very
Yeah.
effective.
Good stuff. Well, so shall we? You mentioned Lojong. Are you down to do a little bit of Lojong slogan training?
I'd love to.
All right, let's do it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to share my screen, and we're going to go over to the LRDC random Lojong slogan generator. Matthew, did you know that the random Lojong slogan generator on the Lion's Roar dharmacenter.org website is the only English random Lojong slogan generator in the world?
I did not know that. I feel blessed.
You are. Our friend Dirk made this, and I'm so grateful to him. I actually have this bookmarked. It's in my, you know, it's in my favorites on my browser. And most mornings when I fire up my computer, because I work from my computer, I open it up and I press the button, I get myself a random Lojong slogan. And it's really a great way to start the day.
That sounds like a great way to start the day. And they're so helpful. Like, I mean, that's the best, right? Because then you have it for that day. You have this basis of practice throughout the day.
Absolutely, without a doubt. And a lot of times, yeah, exactly. It comes back later, you know, like I'll read it in the morning, and sometimes I just sort of, and I read it and I'm like, yeah, okay, And then I go on with my day and I'm not really thinking about it much, right? And then a little bit later, there'll be this sort of aha, like, oh, that's what that's about. Yeah. I wish I could just store them all. I wish I had them memorized, you know, along with the commentary on them. All right, so let's do a little. There we go. We're gonna press the button. Now, all right. So we have one on the screen now. It's called it's point number 49, which is always meditate on difficult points. So normally Jack reads these, but I think you're on a phone, so it's probably pretty hard for you to read, right?
It would be very difficult.
All right. All right, so the listeners will just have to put up with my reading voice. Okay, so always meditate on difficult points. And Tralag Kyabgyan provides the commentary on this one. And it says, it's important to have joy and enthusiasm for our practice, but we should still find it challenging enough to test our capabilities for growth. Difficulties must be welcomed because it's only by overcoming challenges that we develop. We should gradually introduce into our meditation those areas that we normally find upsetting or difficult, instead of choosing meditations that always ease our minds or make us feel good without requiring much effort on our part. If our practice becomes tedious, unproductive, or painful, we need to correct that instead of blaming the practice or succumbing to a defeatist attitude. The distinctive feature of Lojong is the importance it places on topics that challenge our understanding, test our endurance, and stretch our mental capabilities.
Powerful.
What do you think about that?
I think that in the beginning, it's very important to become disciplined in our own regulation. But once that has been achieved to some degree, the only way that we can continue to move forward is by working with others and I think I'm saying that with the idea that difficulties come in that, but even at first, part of regulating ourselves, our own internal world, our nervous system, our behaviors. I mean, there's real difficult sticking points there. And my personal experience is that pretty quickly after beginning meditation, those difficult points showed their faces rather clearly. It took me quite some time to deal with some of them. And of course, like most problems, they're not really as scary or as problematic as I think they are when I'm ignoring. And I have, I have spent time in practice purposely going like, I'm not going to deal with that yet. I just don't want to, right? I want to keep behaving this particular way, even though like I know I'm taking refuge improperly in this thing or not really being in line with my own heart. And that's prolonged suffering for myself and others. And the more I practice and become confident in this practice, the more I actually want to face those difficulties because they continue to show me that if I do that, like the best opportunities arise.
Yeah, well said. I think like that, especially, that there's this resistance, to bringing to sort of bringing light to those dark areas where we're ignoring something. But like you said, those areas are causing us suffering and others suffering. But it's interesting to note how when we overcome that resistance, right, or meet that resistance, and use it sort of as Lama would has said on a few occasions to me as a springboard, right? That what's on the other side of that resistance, the thing that to be lit up and released, is the most beneficial thing possible. It's amazing to me every time, like you like flip it over, and sure, it takes some effort, and you have to have courage, and you have to overcome, your fears and whatnot around whatever that is. But when you flip it, all of a sudden you discover almost like a new power, right? Or a new beneficial aspect of life that you hadn't considered before.
I really like this in Zen. They say it's like, when we have a problem, it's like two like wringing two hands, wringing them together, And then when we face the problem, it just kind of dissolves. It's just like, no more wringing the hands. Like the hands are still here. Everything's actually just the same. It's just the problem.
I
Like
love that.
we were kind of creating a problem with the ringing, ringing of the hands.
Huh, I like it. I haven't heard that one before. Thanks for sharing it. It's a good visual. And truly, that is how it is, right? We're creating our own ringing of the hands there. I have a question though on a practical level. So for me, I'm still, I'm pretty new to all of this, and mostly most of my formal meditation practice is shamatha practice, right? And sure enough, I mean, there are times where, things may come up in that practice, and or I might bring something up intentionally to focus on, to gather some insight perhaps on. But for the most part, what I notice anyway for me is that it's usually post-meditative states where I might be dealing with challenging things, right? So like it's oftentimes not in my formal practice. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts or advice or pointers about how to, so it's, what Trolley Kyabgyan says here is that we shouldn't always be choosing meditations that always ease our minds or make us feel good without requiring much effort on our part. So, how do we introduce into our meditation those areas that we normally find upsetting or difficult?
Thanks. I think even on a very like gross level, in doing shamatha, if we're right, we're coming back to our breath, right? Coming back all the time. But we can pay attention to what it is that's distracting us. Sometimes that the advice given is like, well, what was the thought before you got distracted? And this, I, from my experience, will point me to the problem areas. Because it's a problem area that shoots me off from the present moment. So something comes up and then I'm off and running. And then I catch myself, I have the big success of becoming aware that I'm off and running or I'm dreaming, and I come back. Right? So that's good because the more I've practiced coming back, the more I've noticed what it is that got me to run away.
I'm glad you brought up the dreaming part of it, because I was, when you were talking, I was like, man, I try to notice what the thing was that pulled me away. And it is 95% of the time some type of dreamy state. And what it was that pulled, you know how dreams, you know how it starts with just like a, there's just like a little flicker of a thought or something, right? And then it just pull, then it just evolves in some kind of like madness, right? It's just one thing on top of another, on top of another, oftentimes disjointed, not even necessarily related to each other in any kind of serious way. And it feels to me so sort of like just big fluffy thoughts, right? And so they don't like that. I find that dreaming stuff, I think, I feel like that is incredibly challenging, but I don't. And I get maybe upset about that, right? Like if I notice that I'm, oh man, I'm just like I'm having a hard time bringing myself back, I might find that a little bit upsetting or difficult. But I don't usually detect like a topic or a particular thought, like a concrete thing to focus on.
When I first started, I noticed like I would be on loop with like five primary subjects in terms of I'll just call myself. This is a long time ago. But I would be like really proud of myself for starting to meditate. Look at me, I'm meditating. Right. So that would take me off. So like once I kind of got a flavor for that, I realized like, oh, I have this like there's something there with like performance and accomplishment that I need to specifically meditate on. Like, how is this affecting my life, and how am I bringing this to the table in like my continuous involvement in my life, right? Because these primary modes of being that start to show up are very in front of how we connect with our life, right? So then I would be like, then think like, oh, okay, that, I tried to come back to the moment, I started breathing, okay, I'm back in the moment. And then I kind of started ruminating on like, man, like, geez, the minute I start, I get so proud of myself. Like, how silly is that, right? So then I go into like a negative criticism. So like, well, that's another difficult. So I think we have to kind of like look at the actual experience we're doing and then look at those as points. So that would be a thought. And I know you asked me about something different. Then there's this other area, which is like a discomfort in being, like in existing. And I think for me, a lot of time, that's what leads to the dreamlike states is, a big one for me is boredom, right? Like I
Yeah, you
might
nailed it.
really settle in and then all of a sudden I'm like really here. And then it's like, oh, how long do I have to be here?
Bro, you nailed it. You nailed it. You nailed it,
Yeah.
man. Okay. All right. Yeah. All right. thanks. I know. Now I know the upsetting and difficult point that I need to work with, or at least one of them, because that's exactly it. I recognize that as well, where, basically I'm sitting there and things are very clear. I'm very, present, and, I as mindful as I can be. And then I'm like, anyway, right? And off I go into some kind of la la dreamland, right? And it's distracting, and that's interesting. Thank you. I appreciate that. That's super helpful.
My pleasure. I hope so. I know for me, it's been something that's been really difficult to work with. And there's a sense of I want to get more out of existing than just existing. Right? So there's this aspect of like wanting to grab. Wanting to pull in, and it's a little, it's like this really subtle aggression toward peace.
Just gonna let that sit for a minute. Yeah, it is, isn't it? Hmm.
Think so.
I remember. I remember when I first got sober from alcohol years ago for the first time, and I remember how much calmer things were and how much more peaceful things were, and how much I hated it. I was just like. People say they want peace, but I don't think people want peace. I mean, I was like, I know I don't want a peace. I want to stir something up, right? Let's get things going. Let's have some fun, some excitement. Let's get, some movement here, right? So, yeah, it is. It's interesting how it takes on these different levels. And I think too, one thing that I noticed in those distractions is something that Jack and I talk quite a lot about, which is the eight worldly concerns, right? Like, oh, right, I'm really focused on, pleasure or avoiding pain, right? Like, or getting, getting other people to respect me, that kind of thing. So, there are these themes there, even if the thoughts aren't distinct enough, I can definitely pick up on the themes. And it's interesting too, don't you think? Like how that when you begin to sit with it, how you really get to see the self, right? I always kind of feel like it's like a, like ghosts are invisible, right? And you in the cartoons or whatever, you throw some like chalk powder or some flour or something on them, and then you can see them, right? And I feel like that's kind of oftentimes like how it is in meditation, that there's these. There's this crap that kind of like covers up the self, and then the sense of self anyway. And then all of a sudden you're like, there's me, look at me. Like, wow, I'm just craving and avoiding and ignoring.
The misperceived me.
misperceived me. Thank you. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, without a doubt. Cool. Thanks for that. That was a good one.
That was a good one. What a good Lojong
Heck yeah.
segment. And I
Heck
do,
yeah.
I found it really challenging in my own practice and to transmit this idea of how to look at emotional states and thought patterns as if they're a difficulty, and then how to kind of deal with them.
Can you say that again?
I think it's one thing to be trying to be present and having thoughts and feelings swirling And then actually in that presence, noticing patterns. And being able to identify, oh, this is a thought pattern that's actually coming up quite a bit for me. Or this is a an emotional state with which I am often in. And then to say like, oh, actually that can change. But I need to kind of figure out what that is. Like, what is this pattern? Why am I? What's behind it? What's behind it? Like, how am I meeting life with it? And is this how I want to meet life?
No, I like it. I like what you're saying. It reminds me actually, I was in while I was preparing for the show, I was going through some notes from Lama's talks from a while ago, looking for where he was talking about trauma and dealing with trauma. And one thing that he said is something similar to what you're talking about, I think, which is that that basically that this whole process that we're involved in is one of backing out, like backing up, right? And he likened it to being stuck in a labyrinth with a monster, right? And so you don't want to keep going deeper and deeper into it. You want to back out, but this it's a basically it feels like it's like a deconstruction process, but you have to be able to see these patterns, right? You got to be able to, as you're backing out, you're seeing it, right? And of course it's back, you're going back and forth, right? But at the same time, there's this sort of like, how did I get here? Like, what is this? What is this pattern that keeps happening again and again and again? What's giving rise to that, right? Like examining it and then noticing that we can intentionally change that pattern over time.
And I think a word you use that's really important in that investigation is what? I think I've always had a tendency to say, like, well, why? Why am I thinking like that? Why am I feeling this way? And like, I'm not trying to totally discount that, but it is, right? That's like actually jumping into the labyrinth, like really deep. And just
Right,
then starting to
exactly.
feel like, oh, around and around and down and like, or like the metaphor of like peeling the onions and then peeling the layers of the onion, and then you realize like it's eternal. If you're working on peeling, but to say what, just what am I experiencing right now? And then knowing that we're actually empowered to shift that. And I think that for a long time I worked with that shift from a critical place. So taking the thing like, okay, so I feel a little aggressive towards peace. I'm getting bored. I just don't want to be peaceful. And I don't want to make the changes in my life that lead to peace. Right? So if I start regarding the sensations, the feelings, and the thoughts that come along with that, the behaviors with a crit in a critical way of myself, and then start really trying to like muscle myself to do better or to do different. Like I have my experience has been like I ramp up. I tend to be much less peaceful and I start doing more unpeaceful things. Right. So there has to be some sort of identification of like what, and then treating myself like my own friend. That's
Man, it's more difficult than it sounds like. Right? That process of befriending that yourself in that way and being compassionate towards yourself, because especially, like you mentioned, it's easy to come at it with a very critical attitude.
Yeah, that seems to be in speaking with people very common. That like there's a regard for ourselves that is critical and as if we are something to be fixed.
That's right. That's right.
A
Yeah.
performance oriented type being.
That's not what this is about, is it?
So.
I don't think so either. Well, I think this is a nice segue into the topic that we were hoping to talk about a little bit about, I was curious. So we were going to be talking about trauma a little bit. And I was curious, how do you, so one of the things that I think about with trauma is that essentially, like, the formation of myself was a traumatic, is a traumatic, my misperceived self is a traumatic experience. It's just informed by tons of them, some small, some large, but that there's essentially like this feeling on my end that there's nothing more, like it's like the chiseling out process, the definition, the defining identification process that we go through to become these selves, that is a traumatic experience. It's a whole bunch of many traumatic experiences. And then it feels like when I say that, it feels like it's sort of minimizing actual trauma, what we typically refer to as trauma. And I was hoping, you have a lot of experience in working with people who are or have suffered a lot of trauma. And I was curious how you like define it. How do you think of it?
And we're talking about the type of trauma that you do not want to minimize.
That's right.
So a lot of times I refer to that as like capital T trauma, as opposed to like small T trauma. I like talking about that type of trauma from a like body keeps the score type mindset,
Yeah.
Russell Underkolk. And so how he describes that type of trauma is we had an experience that was to such an intense degree that we could not process it fully in the moment. And then that was absorbed or embodied within us. And often, even after the fact, it becomes very difficult to process. And by process, what I mean is be fully present with the sensations and feelings in the moment that the thing is happening.
In the moment that the what thing is happening.
What we would call the when the trauma occurred, the traumatic event. So as the traumatic event was happening,
Oh, you couldn't deal with it, right?
we were unable to be completely present with our thoughts, emotions, and
Yeah.
sensations.
So it's like it like locks it in and kind of tucks it away somehow. Is that is it like because so the book you referenced, I haven't read it, but it's The Body Keeps the Score, is that right?
Body keeps the score.
So I always think, to me, I always think of it as, and I recognize there's not necessarily there's no dualism here, right, with the mind and body and all of that, but like I always think of it as the mind sort of is what gets impacted and altered by trauma. And I'm curious about like the physical body, how it's related.
So I think that there, we should, because of the nature of this podcast, we should make an important distinction that when you're saying mind, we're talking about a Western concept of mind that is very much the creation of our nervous system,
Yeah.
right? And probably, I don't know, chicken egg, like how those two things in Western medicine like relate to each other. You know what I mean? I don't know if I'm making sense, but that what the Western mind.
Yes, yeah, that's what I meant.
As opposed to like the Buddhist concept of mind. And so I would just say like that, like there can't really be a distinction because the brain is operating the nervous system just like the nervous system is intaking information to operate the brain and vice versa, right? So in that way of viewing our reality, I don't think we can separate those two things.
So what happens? So there's the initial trauma during which we can't be present to what's actually occurring. And then something happens to the, if something happens, right? What is it that happens? How is the score being kept?
Right. So I'll use a practical example. Trying to think of which practical example to use. And so my initial training in this area came from working with vets. And through so actually Buddhist facilitators, but in a veterans program. And so we can look at film and studies from as early as World War I of how post-traumatic stress manifests, right? So we know that somehow these individual soldiers were in a traumatic event like we talked about, and then the result is actually different throughout time. So like first they called it shell shock. So for some reason during that time period, post-traumatic stress was often exhibited in ways where the people could no longer like walk in functional ways. Their body would be very jerky and stuff. That seems to have primarily gone away, where now post-traumatic stress exhibits itself in symptoms like highly agitated states, very easy startled states. So their nervous system is all on alert, and certain behaviors like what they call reconnaissance behavior, meaning like they won't go somewhere until they've like they'll maybe do a drive-by first, and doing behaviors like safety behaviors, kind of obsessive compulsive behaviors like checking locks multiple times, having weapons stored in easily accessible areas throughout the house, like hypervigilance. So we can see that after these events, the nervous system somehow changes and modifies itself to meet the threat of the traumatic event. And that's why a lot of vets will say, well, like this isn't a disorder, so they've taken to calling it PTS. Post-traumatic stress, not post-traumatic stress disorder, because it's like, well, this isn't a disorder. This is a very reasonable response for the
Yeah,
nervous
fair
system
enough.
to
I, yeah.
things like that. So that would be just one example is PTSD, but we find that people have I also do body work, and so in the study of body work in relation to that, we see that people will have physical holding patterns that they report back as they have these different areas worked on, the trauma is released, meaning that as these areas of their body where they have holding patterns, or maybe they're like kind of like, like their shoulders up all the time, it cannot get it to relax. It'll just go right back up, right? As they work through somatic processes, somatic just meaning like with the body. As those things relax, the memories, sensations, things like that begin to come to the surface again. and they're able to work through those emotions and their narrative about the traumatic event.
It's amazing. Like, yeah, that the part about the holding patterns, you know, I find that fascinating. You know, because I can totally see how like areas of the brain, like the amygdala, for example, might be affected by all of this, right? And create what do they call it, like hyperarousal and this sort of fight flight kind of responsiveness. It's so interesting to me how the body, the physical body as well, right? Like those patterns are there, and how working on them physically can lead to this shift in relating to the trauma itself. That's mind bending.
It is. I think it's reflected really well in Buddhism too, in the sense that the whole being is a perception apparatus. And to think that, right, like it's only the ears that hear, it's only the eyes that see, right, is not actually accurate. You know, there's this very holistic thing, and even our organs are perceiving creation in their own way and informing the rest of the being.
So how do you, so the when, so there's this aspect of the physical release or physical processing. I'm curious, like, so how do you, is do you do mindfulness practices as well, besides, in addition to the body work, to sort of bring people sort of into their body, right, or help them to be a little bit more grounded and present? Are there mindfulness practices that you advocate for, advise people who are suffering, like vets, for example, to engage in, to get them to a place where they can encounter these traumatic experiences and process them?
I do. For me, the only way to do that ethically is in what I call a client-led approach. So what that means is make offerings from the beginning of body work. And then I watch, and if the client takes that offering and begins, then I might offer another step. But it's never going to be like, hey, you have to do this or something like that, because it just won't work, right? And in my, like, the way I understand it, like if somebody comes in, they're like, I got to heal my trauma through my body, let's do somatic work. I'm like, okay, first do this. Now, no, you're not doing it. You need to do it. Now do this. Now do that. It's not going to work.
Right.
Because that's actually where a lot of trauma comes from, is from us forcing our bodies into, and that's probably the small T trauma, forcing our bodies into situations that the body does not want to be in, because a lot of us have a hard time listening to it as a full perceptive instrument. We're doing everything we do with our bodies because of our intellect. We have to do this. We have to do that. I have to do this because I want these things, right? And, or I don't want these things, so I have to avoid this and I have to avoid that. And the actual experience of being alive is not just intellectual. So if I have a client trying to do work from an intellectual approach, it's not going to be effective. But like if I say the first prompt is going to be, hey, I work on a pressure scale of 1 to 10. We're never going to get anywhere near 10. I'm going to try to warm around a 2 or 3. I'll show you what that is in my mind. But actually, only you know how much pressure I'm putting. Like you tell me, right? It's your experience. And I'm gonna try to go deeper on a 4 to 5. Every once in a while, I'm gonna get really deep if I find something. Really deep is gonna be a 6, but I don't ever want to go to a 7. And then I'll be listening, because that doesn't even make any sense. How could someone tell a 6 from a 7? Right? Like, it's totally made up. And so if they're curious, then I'll tell them, like, well, the difference between a 6 and a 7 is what I'd like you to do is stay really connected to your breath and do slow diaphragmatic belly breathing. And when I start getting close to that 7, you're not going to be able to do that anymore. You'll become disconnected from your breathing. Another thing that's going to happen is a separate body that I'm not working on will begin to clench to deal with the pressure. So, right. So now I've just created a situation where the person's doing diaphragmatic breathing, which is like the basis for all somatic healing, actually. And then the mindfulness of paying attention to it, staying connected to themselves and to their whole instrument and like where they're holding tension. Right. And so then if we start working, they're actually doing that, then a second step comes into being, which is, like I was saying, they don't, we tend to put our bodies in situations they don't really want to be in. Right? So our body subconsciously does not trust our conscious mind. And in this process, there's the opportunity for the client to begin that relationship with himself, because when pressure gets too hard, or if the pressure is too light and it's experienced, and they say, the conscious mind looks out for the body and says, that's too much pressure. That's not enough pressure. A trusting relationship begins to be developed. And then, of course, I'm going to respond with what they ask. And then there's another level of trust that's being built. And so that would be like the beginning of the prompts, right? Just those would be the offerings. And then it's like, I just see if that happens.
And there's no, yeah, there's no, I mean, I'm struck by how mindful you, as someone who's trying to he help them heal, how mindful you have to be, right, yourself in the entire practice of helping them, right? So you have to inform them, you have to give them space, you have to collaborate with them, you have to, encourage them. You have to do all these things, but you have to be very sensitive to what's going on with them, right? In order to be responsive. There's no fast track to trauma healing, huh?
I don't think it can be put on a timeline.
I'm also, I find it interesting how the there is this, like it remains with me, this body mind duality, right? That I can't help but like be amazed by the fact that the body work that you're talking about doing, where you would start with that's a form of mind training, and helping people become aware of their entire instrument, so to speak. And at the end of the day, I mean, if we're capable of doing that, we'll be living much better lives, regardless of how many big T or little T traumas we've experienced. If we can have this holistic view that sees the entire organism, and is able to befriend it, as you were talking about earlier, we'll be in a much better position to lead good lives ourselves and be helpful. It amazes me, right? Like how much work you've had to do on yourself in order to get into a place where you can help others in this way.
And there's a reciprocal process in that the organism continues to grow.
What do you mean by that?
Like at first, I think that it stops at my skin.
Thank you. That's enough. That's fantastic. Oh my gosh. I'm sad now, Matthew, a little bit, because
Yeah, me
it's
too. We
we
can talk more after this, though, and I know we will.
We will. We'll definitely be talking. I'm so grateful for the time that you spent on the show, and I wish that we had spent a little bit more time talking about the trauma stuff, because I feel like there's so much more to be said and so much. I've got like a basic kindergartner's or pre-kindergartner's understanding of how it happens in the first place, and then how to resolve it. But certainly, I feel illuminated by you talking with me tonight.
I so appreciate your curiosity and your ability to ask questions and to stay engaged. It's so much fun, and I actually had like little notes about what to talk about, and we went nowhere, but I thought we would talk about.
No.
This was really fun and fascinating. So thank you so much, Daniel. I really appreciate you
Thank
inviting me
you.
being
Yeah,
here with you.
absolutely. I appreciate you so much, Matthew. And I will definitely be talking to you soon. Thank you to everybody out there in Talk Openly Land, and we'll catch you later.
Love you, Booze.
Love you too. Bye.